Up next, we have our book reading program, Ohomoni Iyotaka, read by Gail Hubling.
The Lakota Way, Stories and Lessons for Living by Joseph M. Marshall III. Chapter 9, Bravery. Wo'ohitika, Having or Showing Courage, the Story of Defender. Long ago, our people survived by hunting and by fighting when necessary, so Lakota boys had to learn the skills to be providers as well as protectors, hunters as well as warriors. For skills like making weapons, tracking and shooting bows and arrows, a boy needed good hands and a good eye. It was easy to see which boy was good with the bow or which was good at tracking, but to be a good hunter and warrior, it was also necessary to be brave, and that could not always be seen in a boy. We believed that it was in everyone to be brave, but we also knew that boys had to be given the chance to learn that they could be brave. My grandmother told me a story about one boy long ago. His boyhood name was Hoka, the badger. Though he was named for a ferocious animal, he was a quiet child. In fact, he hardly ever cried when he was a baby. In time, he would earn another name. Hoka was eager to learn. By the time he was 12, he could make arrows better than most grown men. By the time he was 14, he was deadly with a bow. He could look at a track and know what animal had passed by and when. He was quiet and often went off alone, so his father worried. One of Hoka's uncles said it was time to see what the boy was made of. One day, that uncle organized a hunting party and invited Hoka along. It was customary for a boy on the edge of manhood to be invited along on a hunt or the warpath as a helper. Such a helper did chores around the camp, but also was given the chance to learn from the experience. The hunting party was after elk. A medicine dreamer needed the fine hide of a mature elk to make into a courting robe, and some of the old ones in the village needed fresh meat. So after the proper preparations, the hunters departed. They found a good spot for a hunting camp in a valley thick with cottonwood and oak. Hoka helped to set up the camp while some of the hunters went on a scout. They returned with good news. The next morning, with Hoka carrying the extra weapons, water, and food pouches, the hunters went after their game. They were successful. They returned to camp with two fine elk. The elk were skinned and butchered. Hoka's uncle said the hunters would go out again the next day and that Hoka would stay behind to guard the camp. Guarding the camp was a big responsibility. Coyotes, wolves, or bears would come after the fresh meat, so someone had to stay behind. More importantly, guarding the camp was the same as defending the village where there were many helpless, like the old ones and the women and the children. This was an important lesson for a boy about to become a man. Soon after sunrise, the hunters left, assuring Hoka that they would return by sundown. His uncle reminded the boy that the elk meat would feed many families back in the village, so nothing must happen to it. He reminded him the elk hides for the medicine dreamer had been stretched out to dry and that they were very important as well. Hoka gathered his bows and arrows and promised he would guard the camp. The camp was well hidden in the oak and cottonwood near the creek, but that also meant an enemy could sneak up close under cover. The meat was hanging from a pole placed in the forks of two young cottonwoods and covered with cut willow branches. Though out of sight, the meat could not be hidden from the keen noses of the four-legged meat-eaters. Of that, Hoka was well aware. Yet the first visitor was not four-legged. It was the loud black-and-white magpie, an opportunist who quickly announced his discovery to the whole valley. Soon a flock of magpies surrounded the camp. A well-placed cloud of dirt now and then kept the magpies away, but they made themselves a constant nuisance and their loud screechy calls were no less a bother. Hoka knew that other creatures like the short-tailed cat, the great cat, coyotes, bears, and wolves often followed the loud calls of the magpies. Wolves and coyotes would not attack two-leggeds, but bears and the great cat were another matter, so Hoka kept his weapons close and his eyes on the surrounding trees. At mid-morning, Hoka was tired of throwing dirt clods at the magpies and went to the creek to fill his water pouch. Returning to the camp, he came upon a large track resembling a bear's paw print. He studied it carefully. The print was not deep, but it was large, and Hoka couldn't remember seeing it on his way to the water. Back at camp, he strung his bow and put his arrows within easy reach. Bears could be killed with a bow. A few hunters had done it, but they were grown men and much stronger than he, and with stouter bows than his. There were also a few stories of hunters who had been killed or maimed by an angry, wounded bear, like the man named Crooked Leg, whose ankle had been broken by a bear with one bite. After the charging buffalo, a bear with a hump in his back was the most dangerous four-legged anywhere. Hoka was more watchful, keeping his eyes and ears open. Only the leaves, grasses, and shrubs were moving with the gentle breeze that flowed through the grove. The only sounds were the loud magpies. He was about to think that the track he had found was old when something scared away the magpies. With loud screeching, they flapped away from the grove. Other birds fled as well, leaving behind a sudden silence. Hoka crouched with his bow, his back to a tree, and placed an arrow on the string. Whatever had frightened the magpies had to be something more dangerous than a coyote. The possibilities were not good. Only a ferocious hunter like the gray short-tailed cat, the great yellow cat, the wolf, or a bear could frighten away every other creature. He listened hard and looked closely all around. There was only the silence and nothing moved, as if the breezes had fled too. Hoka glanced up at the sun. It was not yet the middle of the day, meaning there was a long wait until sundown and the hunters returned. He was alone against whatever had caused the strange silence. It dragged on. Perhaps something had just passed through, he hoped. Then he heard a rustling in the bush. Hoka took a position to shoot. He had seen bears at a distance, but never up close. Once, while hunting with his father, he had witnessed the great yellow cat take down a deer. It had been very swift and powerful. What was out there among the trees, he didn't know, but he imagined he would be able to get off one shot, maybe two. Once again, there was only the silence. Hoka relaxed a little, but he kept the bow in his hand, the arrow still held on the string. He pressed his back against the tree and slowly swept his gaze all around until he completed the circle. Still, there was nothing but silence. He began to consider what to do if a bear or the great cat came for him across the clearing. Both of those four-leggeds were very swift. They could outrun a two-legged easily. One shot was all he could get if that, and one arrow wouldn't kill any animal that large. The tree next to him was a large cottonwood with high branches. He could climb it high enough to be out of a bear's reach, because the humpback bear couldn't climb trees, but the yellow cat could easily. Hoka pondered. What was he to do? He could go and look for the hunters, he thought, but they were counting on him to guard the meat. Hunting wasn't easy. It was hard work requiring much skill and patience. If a bear or a great yellow cat came in and took the meat while he was off looking for the hunters, he would be responsible. Everyone would make fun because it would look like he ran away. Hoka sighed deeply. Clearly there was nothing to do but defend the camp. Still he knew very well what a bear or a great yellow cat could do to him. He shuddered at the thought of it. One of the hunters had left behind a lance, so Hoka brought that close. It would be the last thing he would use if his arrows missed, or if he couldn't get off more than two shots. The rustling came again, this time off to his left. Hoka swung around to shoot, but saw nothing. The noise was louder this time. Whatever made it was not a small animal like a badger or a fox. It had to be large. Something moved, something dark and large and fast. Hoka caught the movement in the corner of his eye. He gasped and swung around. A dark figure disappeared behind some trees. Hoka waited, trying not to breathe hard because it would spoil his aim if he had to shoot. Now he knew for certain there was something out there. He suddenly realized his heart was thumping against his chest. Hoka tried to reason past his fear. He guessed it was not a great yellow cat because the cat was a stalker. Its way of hunting was to move in close without being seen and then spring. The thing out there was dark, perhaps black and not tawny yellow. It could only be a bear. Something was out there, and he might have to face it. Remembering the story of the hunter from a village to the north, he preferred to face a bear. His grandfather had told him of a man hunting near the Great Muddy River. The man noticed a great cat watching him. It followed him across a creek into a forest and up a tree. The cat was relentless, screaming and growling as it climbed. Somehow the hunter thrust his lance as the cat leaped. It impaled itself in both. Cat and hunter fell, crashing to the forest floor. That hunter had been very lucky. He lived to tell the story and made a fine bow casing, arrow quiver from the cat's hide. The last thing Hoka wanted to face was the great yellow cat. Truth was, he didn't want to face the bear either, but it seemed as if he would have no choice. His gaze swept the grove all around him once again. His mouth was dry. He removed his shirt so that its sleeves wouldn't get in the way of the bowstring. Taking out 3 arrows, he stuck them in the ground in front of him and arranged the quiver full of at least 20 arrows at his left hip. Pounding the arrow on a string, he calculated 4 fast shots if he had time. A loud thrashing from behind startled him. He whirled and bent his bow, expecting to see some large black thing coming from him. The noise stopped. With bated breath, he waited, looking and listening. Far off to his right came a low, throaty growl. The bear, if it was a bear, had moved swiftly to flank him. Hoka waited. He looked down and realized that he spilled out all the arrows from his quiver. Hands trembling, he retrieved the shafts and slid them back in. Taking deep breaths to calm himself, he peered into the trees to the right. The thing had moved from left to right, circling him. Perhaps the wise thing was to look ahead to where it might be, he thought. He was right. Another low, throaty growl floated through the grove. Hoka heard the dog snarl too, but this sound seemed to be coming from a deep hole. All he could do was point his half-drawn bow in the direction of the growl. He wished with all his heart that the hunters were back, but sundown was far, far off. How angry would my uncle be, he wondered, if I went to a safer place away from this bear? There was no way to know that, of course, but he was on the verge of running as far and as fast as he could. Then he decided to climb the tree. In the tree, he was still near enough to see anything that came near the meat. If it was a bear, he could try shouting and scaring it away. If that didn't work, he could shoot at it from a safe perch. Gathering the lance and his bow and arrows, Hoka quickly climbed up. He found a good solid fork higher than the height of 2 men. There he lodged his lance and found a branch to hang his quiver. And he had a better view of the clearing. As he settled in, he heard another growl. He swung around in time to see a dark figure scurrying through the brush, circling the camp, it seemed. Hoka felt safe in the tree. He made certain of his footing and balance and placed an arrow on the bowstring. The dark figure, he was sure it was a bear, stopped at some low shrubs well within bowshot. He would have to shoot between 2 trees, but he was certain he could hit it from this distance. The dark figure rose from his hiding place, slowly. It was a bear, and it appeared to be looking at him. Perhaps a near miss would scare it away, he thought. Hoka bent his bow, took careful aim, and released. His arrow flashed toward the bear, which ducked out of sight. Hoka thought he heard a cry, a startled grunt of surprise, followed by a thrashing in the shrubs. Then there was silence. Wounded animals were dangerous, he had been told. He expected the bear to come after him and try to climb the tree. He prepared another arrow and waited. The silence continued. No more growls, no more movement in the brush. Hoka kept an eye on the place where he last saw the bear, waiting for it to emerge in a fury. Nothing happened. There was no movement anywhere in the grove. Hoka looked around from his high perch. Only a squirrel was moving about in a nearby oak. He kept his bow at the ready. All he could do was wait and wonder if he had killed the bear with 1 arrow. It didn't seem likely. The sun reached the middle of the day and began its slide down to the western rim of the prairie. Still Hoka waited, reluctant to leave the safety of the tree. He put away his bow and made himself comfortable, settling himself in the fork of 2 large branches. A magpie flapped his way through the trees and alighted on the branches above the hanging elk meat, sending his raucous call to all his relatives. Hoka breathed a sigh of relief. That could only mean that there was no more danger from the bear. More and more magpies came until there was a line of the black and white birds on the cut branch holding up the elk meat. Hoka thought to loose an arrow to frighten them off. Then he realized they were his sentinels. If any kind of danger approached, they would fly off. And even all those magpies together couldn't carry off the meat, so he let them be. The afternoon dragged on, and the shadows grew longer and longer. Hoka decided to climb down. On the ground, he quickly built a fire. The smell of it and the smoke would warn off any animals approaching. The smell of smoke would also let a 2-legged enemy know where the camp was, but he decided to take a chance. His friends, the magpies, were still worrying about the meat, and he was certain they would let him know if anything came close, but he kept his weapons at hand nonetheless. Hoka was curious about the bear, if it was a bear. Magpies were unafraid, so he decided to take a look. At the last moment, he grabbed the lance instead of his bow. Caution guided his every move as he carefully went from tree to tree until he found the brush where the bear had been hiding. His heart pounding, he climbed a tree for a better look. He saw nothing. Back on the ground, he stepped silently through the brush until he found broken stalks and torn-up grass and blood. His arrow had found a mark. Wisely, he retreated to his fire, built it up, and waited. The magpies were still fussing over the elk meat. He couldn't let down his guard now. There was a wounded bear out there somewhere. The hunters. Hoka hoped the bear wouldn't see the hunters and attack them. A shout startled him. The hunters were returning from the east, and the bear had run off to the west. Hoka was relieved, never so glad to see anyone in his life. A buck deer with large antlers lay across a drag pole pulled by two of the hunters. They all looked tired, and Hoka's uncle seemed to be hurt. A questioning glance from Hoka brought out the story. One of them shot the buck. In his confusion, it ran at their hiding place and trampled Hoka's uncle. It was not a serious injury, Hoka was told, but there was blood. All is well here? Asked Hoka's uncle. Yes, replied Hoka. The meat is still hanging there. We have been away since this morning. Did anything happen? Hoka thought for a moment. He wanted to tell them about the bear, but more than likely they would not believe him. No, he said, nothing happened. Except for the magpies, they are still trying to carry off the meat. The hunters looked at him and chuckled. You have guarded the camp well, one of them said. Hoka smiled. They did not know how true the words were. It would be good if we kept watch tonight, he said. I hear there are bears here. Spoken like a true hunter and a good man, said his uncle. Yes, we will take turns keeping watch. Bears are very smart and tricky. You never know what they will do, especially if they smell fresh meat. Hoka grew into a fine young man. At his naming ceremony, his father and his uncle gave him the name Naichiji, the Defender. It was a name he never dishonored. Defender was a skilled hunter and a strong warrior. His family was always well-fed and dressed, and he saw to the needy as well. As a fighting man, he won many war honors, but he was always a quiet man, never boastful. Of that, his mother and father were very proud. Defender courted and won the love of a fine young woman. They were married, and she gave birth to a daughter. Defender's uncle came with a gift for his granddaughter. He brought an arrow. A bear gave me this, he told the infant, with her mother and father listening. Long, long ago, he received it from one of the bravest young men he had ever met, he said. I give it to you now, granddaughter. Hold it in your hand and let its spirit pass on to you so that one day you will grow up to be the mother of brave hunters and warriors. It belongs to your father, one of the bravest men I have ever known. Being brave. What is bravery, and why is it a requisite virtue? Many of us believe that the ultimate display of bravery can only happen on the battlefield. Facing the possibility and sometimes the probability of death and great bodily harm is without a doubt one of the most daunting realities any human being can confront. Bravery, however, needs to be taken in context because life demands it in so many ways. In January of 1951, a 5-year-old boy on the Rosewood Sioux Reservation was sent on a simple errand of taking a bag full of fresh meat to relatives who lived below the hill from him and his grandparents. It was after dark, though. There was a full moon, and the relative's house was a 2.5-mile walk on new-fallen snow. The boy was familiar with the road. He had been on it many times, but never alone at night. It was a pleasant evening for January, with just enough of a nip in the air to make the snow crunch under his feet as he walked. The sky was clear, and it was altogether a very beautiful winter night with the proliferation of stars and the moonlight reflecting off the snow. The boy walked easily without the least amount of concern. He switched the cloth bag from one hand to the other and began to swing it back and forth with the rhythm of his walking. Somewhere in the distance, a coyote barked, followed by the tremolo cry of a screech owl. Nothing was unfamiliar to the boy, not the coyote or the owl, the starry moonlit night, the snow, the cold, or the land itself. Halfway to the relative's house, however, there arose a slight aberration that caused a tiny inkling of concern. aberration persisted in the inkling of concern due to the first symptoms of fear. The boy, as you recall, was swinging the bag of meat back and forth as he walked. At the back end of the swing, it unexpectedly touched something ever so slightly. Instantaneously, a swirl of thoughts and images flew through the boy's mind, but he didn't dare alter the pattern of the swinging of the bag. Horrendously large, black, hungry things with frothy white fangs and long, curved claws were predominant among the images in his mind. They were obviously after the bag of meat first, and after that, the boy had two choices as he saw it. He could drop the bag and run, or he could run with the bag. The second choice seemed the more honorable because his grandmother had impressed upon him the importance of delivering the meat to the waiting relatives. Even as he pondered his choices, the bag was still touching something at the back end of the swing. The indescribable black things were not going away without a meal. An inspiration flashed through his mind like a shooting star, and before he could stop himself, he was acting on it. He swung the bag backward as hard as he could, after which he intended to run faster than he ever had in his 5 years on Earth, but he didn't have to. A sharp yelp surprised and startled him, and he nearly ran anyway, but he recognized the yelper. It was his dog. The indescribably relieved boy hugged his dog, and they finished the chore and arrived home to report an uneventful journey. In that same year, a young man from the Winnebago tribe of eastern Nebraska, Sergeant Mitchell Red Cloud, was an American infantry soldier in South Korea. His rifle squad was engaged in an intense firefight with a larger North Korean unit and forced to withdraw. Sergeant Red Cloud took up a rear guard position and protected the withdrawal of his squad. He fired at the oncoming enemy and drew its return fire himself, thereby enabling his squad to reach a safe position. In the process, Sergeant Red Cloud's position was overrun by the North Koreans and he was killed. He was posthumously awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. There is no comparison between the courage of a 5-year-old boy and the immeasurable bravery of an infantry soldier who lays down his life for his fellow soldiers. Yet it is a safe bet that somewhere in his childhood, Mitchell Red Cloud faced a defining moment when he had to defend the camp and learn that he was capable of bravery when it was necessary. Fortunately, most of us won't have to experience combat, but we will have to cope with life's challenges and overcome its obstacles. Schoolyard bullies, rush hour traffic, injury, illness, indifference, our own sense of inadequacy, unemployment, indecision, racial prejudice, physical disability, the list is practically endless. There is a nearly constant assault on our sense of well-being and self-esteem, not to mention an occasional or even frequent threat of bodily harm. Such is life. In the 1950s and 1960s, yet another challenge swept into the lives of Native Americans on reservations, as if the whole stigma of reservations wasn't challenging enough. We were constantly reminded of certain elements of mainstream American society, missionaries and educators being the most vociferous, that our only course to happiness was to become white in every way possible. Hard work, they told us, was the answer. Buy into the American dream, they advised. The scary part was they had a plan as well, the Employment Assistance Program, otherwise known as relocation. The rationale behind the Bureau of Indian Affairs relocation program was not totally without merit. In order for Indian males to support their families, they needed a trade and work experience. Relocation would give them both by placing them in areas where they could learn a trade while supporting their families. But several factors ensured the program's failure. Indian families who signed up for relocation were moved from the reservations to cities like Cleveland, Minneapolis, Los Angeles, Denver, Oakland, Dallas, and so on. Most had never been near a large city, and few knew what to expect. Pitifully little, if any, effort had been made to prepare them for life in a city. Culture shock, to put it mildly, was their first reaction. But the worst aspects were substandard living conditions in slums, less than a living wage, and a lack of appropriate follow-up support by the BIA. It isn't difficult to understand, then, that the first thought in the minds of relocated families was to get home the fastest way possible. Although there were a few success stories, the relocation program did not accomplish its purpose. Most of the families went home to their reservations without finishing the program. More than a few did it by hitchhiking. Almost every Native American family in the country had its brush with relocation, and horror stories abound. Confusion was its primary consequence, as well as yet another reason to distrust the federal government, especially the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Relocation turned out to be just another in a long and continued list of challenges to be met, something else to be survived. It was the bear that attacked our camp. Such is life. The Turtle Lady was one of those who lived life bravely. She died a few years ago, and as far as I know, she never married. She was known as the Turtle Lady because she kept a turtle in her handbag. She also had turtle charms and amulets. It was hard to say where she called home. She was known far and wide by Indians and whites alike because she walked everywhere. A woman alone on the highways and backroads of a rural state. Over the years, she crisscrossed the state of South Dakota from one reservation to the next, visiting relatives. Like a turtle, she traveled slowly but always managed to reach her destination. Her name was Elsie Flood, and she greeted everyone with a smile, and everyone who knew her worried about her personal safety because of her chosen lifestyle. Given that some elements of the state's population were not kindly disposed toward Indians, there was reason for Elsie's friends and relatives to worry. To my knowledge, though she had one or two minor incidents, Elsie was never seriously injured. I'll always admire her because she was quiet and unassuming, the epitome of courtesy and bravery. So was Matt Cash, who was 22 when he died of leukemia. This young man was a student of mine who had graduated from the same high school I did. He was one of the brightest young men I've ever known and one of the best foosball players around, but I was most impressed with the dignity and courage he exhibited while he knew he was dying. One expects that kind of strength of spirit from elderly people. It is an affirmation of the lives we should strive to live by. Dignity and courage from a young person facing imminent death, however, is an inspiration. There are at least two inspiring members of my family. In 1989, my sister Barbara's daughter Kim, nearing her 17th birthday, died in a car crash. See dedication. Few things in life are as absolutely heartbreaking as losing a child. Few things as challenging. Whatever doesn't kill you will make you stronger, it is said. Barbara found ways to be strong and courageous. She will always have my admiration for that and my undying gratitude for giving me an example to follow. My father, Joseph Marshall II, was a soldier in the 8th Army Air Corps. He saw combat during some of the mop-up operations on the island of Okinawa in 1945. Before that, as a 12-year-old boy, he faced his first test of bravery and passed with flying colors. He became lost in a blizzard with his horse while bringing home supplies for his family. By allowing the horse to find his own way home, my father learned about trust as well as bravery, but his most daunting challenge was cancer. A tumor was removed from his colon in May of last year. That was followed by chemotherapy treatments for several months. The process is not curative. It is only to prolong a life threatened by terminal illness. At the age of 77, he faced the toughest challenge anyone could be given with the quiet dignity and courage of one who is no stronger to adversity. Years ago, my father faced alcoholism and defeated it. He couldn't defeat the cancer, but he taught all of us how to be brave. He died April 14, 2001. Bravery is a requisite virtue because life demands it. Whether it's cancer, a broken heart, a lost opportunity, a bad business deal, an approaching hurricane, a tough decision, or a dark alley, life will continually throw challenges at us. Any challenge is also an invitation, a standing invitation. The ancient Lakota hunter warrior handcrafted his own bows from ash wood. The strongest bows are made from dry, well-seasoned wood. There are two ways to acquire the kind of wood necessary. The conventional way is to find a young ash tree of the proper height and width. Harvest it and let it dry and cure for at least 5 years. But the hunter warrior was always on the lookout for a mature ash tree that had been struck by lightning. Such a tree had been dried and cured in an instant by the awesome power of lightning, and any bows made from it were by far the strongest. Lightning-struck ash trees were rare, but they were preferred because they had suffered ultimate adversity, and ultimate adversity produces ultimate strength. Such is life. I believe we all have it in us to be brave, that each one of us can defend the camp when it's necessary. Life will give us the opportunity, issuing the invitation to the contest. As time goes on, we will be shaped and strengthened by our challenges. Whether we win each time or not, we will be tempered by adversity. Soldiers dressed in blue had ridden against the south end of the village in the early afternoon on a hot day during the moon of cherries ripening, June, and returned back, outfought by the warriors who had responded to the danger. A new danger came from the north end as another group of soldiers tried to cross the greasy grass river and attack the camp. They were driven back as well and were being chased away toward the north. There was much confusion and noise in the large village that stretched for over 2 miles along the west side of the river. As was the usual procedure when a village was attacked, women and children fled, retreating from the attack. One old woman was concerned about the young men and her family, who were in the thick of the fighting across the river. She took her young granddaughter's hand, and together they waded across the river. Warriors rushing past them to join the fight called for them to go back to the village, but they didn't. They gained a small plateau and could plainly see the fighting. A brown cloud of dust hung over the earth, and the firing from the soldiers' and warriors' guns was one continuous noise. They could see the soldiers running and falling as the Lakota and Shayela, Northern Cheyenne, drove them relentlessly. The old woman stopped on a low, sharp rise as the soldiers gained a high hill to the northeast. Suddenly, a group of soldiers broke off and ran in her direction, but just as quickly they were cut down to a man by the advancing warriors. The old woman could sense that victory was at hand, but the guns were still firing as warriors, many of them on foot, pushed toward the hill, toward the last group of soldiers. The old woman was overcome and began to weep, and then she began to sing. Her clear, strong voice rose amidst the noise of unfettered violence as she sang a strong heart song, a song of courage and honor for the brave warriors defending their people. She raised her arms in prayer and continued to sing one strong heart song after another, while her granddaughter clung to her skirt and watched the battle through wide, fearful, wondering eyes. Soon the guns stopped shooting. There were shouts of victory. The battle is over, and victory belonged to the Lakota and Shayela. But the old woman kept singing, even as the tears ran down her face. A mounted warrior approached, the strain of combat and the flush of victory on his face. He dismounted and draped a red sash across the old woman's arms. He was a crazy dog warrior, one of an elite group who would often stake themselves in one place during a battle with their red sashes, a visible vow to fight until victory or death. He had seen the old woman, heard her singing, and acknowledged her courage. As he rode away, another warrior appeared and did the same, followed by another and another until the old woman was covered with red sashes. Another old woman told me the story when I was a boy. Woven into her silvery braids were strips of red cloth, cloth given to her by her grandmother. She was the young girl who stood with her grandmother as she sang strong heart songs during the greasy grass fight, also called the Battle of the Little Bighorn in 1876. Her grandmother had given her the red strips, she said, to remember her by. But the red strips also reminded her that she could be brave, and that's how she faced her blindness every day. Being brave is having or displaying courage during hardship, being strong in the face of pain. If you don't think you know how to be brave, look around. You'll find someone who does know. Follow him or her. If you follow long enough, you'll learn to have courage, or the courage within you will rise to the top. When that happens, turn around and don't be surprised if someone is following you. And that concludes Chapter 9.
This program is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to Ohomani Iotaka on KDKO 89.5 FM.